Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, May 30th. Today, we take a closer look at Hawaiian Electric's new strategy to cut off power to some communities to reduce wildfire risk. It's modeled after what's in place in California and is to roll out this summer. A village starting to take shape for FESPAC 2024. Hale will be on the move tomorrow as they are to be put in place at the Hawaii Convention Center. Hawaii quilters celebrate 40 years in a big way with 40 shades of red. And we talk about those pesky cockroaches. We also sit down with an entertainment industry trailblazer, Hawaii-born actor and singer Tia Carrere, as we prepare to close out Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month. The conversation starts after the headlines. Well, it is being called the last line of defense against wildfires. Come July, Hawaiian Electric Company plans to begin what's being called a public safety power shutoff plan. It's an advance of the dry season, and it's aimed at reducing risk for wildfires following the Maui disaster. HPR reporter Savannah Harriman-Pote joins us this morning to talk about this. Good morning, Savannah.
Yes, good morning, Catherine.
So, gosh, I mean, we've been hearing that this is, you know, a practice in California, but we haven't really had anything like this, you know, but now we do because of Maui.
Yeah, so this is brand new for us. It's a Public Safety Power Shutoff Program, or a PSPS, an acronym that we will all, I'm sure, become more and more familiar with as we get into fire season. And as you said, there are some places that are really familiar with this. California has had these types of programs in place for many years, but a lot of states are just rolling them out for the first time, like us. Washington and Arizona has utilities that are just starting up these programs, and that's because the risk of wildfires is increasing in a lot of places. And as we know, energized lines, power traveling through lines, can be a risk for sparking dry vegetation. So HECO says, you know what? In some areas, and they have maps on lines that show you exactly where, we are going to cut the power if the fire weather is hazardous. So there's about 48,000 HECO customers on Big Island, Maui, Molokai, and Oahu that may be affected during this fire season. But just because they're rolling out this program on July 1st doesn't mean that the power is going to be shut off. They'll only cut the power if they determine that hazardous weather requires it.
Right, if we're talking wind or dry brush.
Yeah, so conditions similar to what we see in a red flag warning, but Fulton Ching, the senior vice president of HECO, answered some questions yesterday and specified specifically that if the National Weather Service calls a red flag warning, that doesn't mean automatically that HECO is going to initiate a public safety power shutoff program. They'll make that determination and send that out through a bunch of different channels. So they'll send it out through social media, they'll send it out through email and text and phone call, and they also are encouraging people to download their mobile app to get push notifications. So that's how you know that this is going to happen. They say that they'll try to give folks 24 to 48 hours worth of notice so that they can prepare, but they can't guarantee that because weather conditions could change really rapidly.
And so how are you supposed to prepare?
So that's a big question. Emergency managers have been working with HECO on exactly what this is going to mean for customers in these affected areas. And the way they're telling people to prepare is in largely the same way we would prepare for a natural disaster. So that means that you need to have food on hand, several days worth. These public safety power shutoffs may be, you know, 6 to 8 hours, but HECO is preparing for having the power be off for up to 3 days. And then once they determine that the weather has passed, it'll take a while, hours, maybe a day, for them to assess that it's safe to turn the power back on. So you really need to be prepared to buckle down. So power means that we'll have limited access to fresh water, is one big thing. Catherine, I know you and I have talked about how waste infrastructure runs on electricity. It requires electricity to pump water out of the ground. And in some places, taps could run dry after a day without power. So Honolulu Board of Water Supplies, Ernie Lau, was at that press conference with emergency managers and HECO officials yesterday, and he had this message for residents.
Unfortunately, the Board of Water Supply facilities, we have water tanks up on hills. We have wells up in the valleys. And these happen to also be the wildland areas. So we're anticipating probably most, if not all, of our facilities along the leeward coast will be subject to a power shutoff. So we're going to be mobilizing. We have a limited number of backup generators. Our plan, as soon as we get notice, is to mobilize those generators and get them located at key pumping stations along the leeward coast to help make up the additional water needed to meet the daily demand of our customers. One thing I would ask of all our customers for the Board of Water Supply, if the power goes out, immediately think, don't think, I can go water my yard, I can go wash my car. As soon as the power goes out, think about conservation. Think about saving that water that is there, because temporarily, until we can get generators in place on the leeward coast, we're going to rely on whatever water is located in our water tanks.
So this is really about like attitude adjustment, right? We've just got to change our way of thinking.
Yeah, changing our way of thinking and also being really aware of how much of our daily lives run on electricity. So, for instance, if you work from home and you rely on electricity and internet for your job, that's a consideration if you may not have that in your home for a couple of days. Jim Ireland, the director for Honolulu Emergency Services Department, also really emphasized being able to receive emergency communications, right? Because conditions could change. And you want to make sure that you have a way to keep your phone charged for 3 to 4 days. Like, for instance, like a power bank or a couple of power banks for you and your family. HECO has been working with telecommunications just to keep cell service up and running, because that is also something that relies on electricity in these areas. And police departments have ensured that people will still be able to call 911 in case of an emergency. So also keep that in mind. If you have a medical emergency or anything else while the power is out, you will be able to call 911.
And then the folks that are medically fragile, that have equipment that runs on electricity, they also have to be prepared.
Yeah, that's a big question. HECO is trying to take and register those who have energy-dependent medical equipment like home dialysis or ventilators. And they want to be able to give those people as much notice as they can. But right now, it's still really up to those patients individually to make plans, be it getting a generator or being able to relocate. In places where we've seen public safety power shutoff programs be more established, like California, the utilities and the states have worked together to create programs for medically vulnerable people to get backup power. We don't have anything like that yet. So once again, they're saying that it's on the individual to prepare. And this brings up something that the researcher Patrick Murphy, who's a senior scientist with PSE Healthy Energy, is looking at. And that's how public power safety shutoffs kind of hit different people differently. How quickly you can recover from these depends on factors like income. So people who have greater incomes and more disposable incomes, they can get energy systems, they can more easily relocate, they can absorb the costs. But other folks who don't have disposable income don't have that option. Here's Murphy.
If I lose the food in my fridge and I'm wealthy, I'll probably replace it. But if I lose the food in my fridge and I'm poor, it probably means my family is either going to go a little hungry this month, or I'm not going to make a rent payment, because there's no extra money in the budget to buy that food twice. So understanding that and having programs to deal with the disparate impacts of power outages based on income would also be pretty important from a utility and a public policy perspective.
Yeah. All interesting issues that we've got to take into consideration.
Right. And again, this is all brand new for us, but it's not something that's going away. The utility is expecting that the areas that are impacted by these power public safety shutoffs is only going to expand as wildfire risk expands.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Savannah. We've been talking with HVR Savannah Harriman-Pote about a new protocol in place to deal with wildfire risks during this upcoming dry season.
HPR has been recognized with four regional Edward R. Murrow Awards, among the most prestigious honors in news. These achievements mark HPR's commitment to excellence in serving our community across the islands and beyond. To listen to the winning stories, visit hawaiipublicradio.org/murrows.
Hey there, it's Michael Barbaro, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look into the world's biggest stories. Catch The Daily, Monday through Thursday at 1:30, here on HPR One.
As we indicated earlier, the jury in the trial of former President Donald Trump has reached a verdict, and that verdict is guilty on 34 felony counts of falsifying business records in a case that began with the payment to porn star Stormy Daniels. NPR will have special coverage on the verdict at the top of the hour on All Things Considered, but we're continuing more with the conversation. And, you know, it takes a village to create a village. Starting tomorrow, the Hawaii Convention Center will be the hub for the Culture and Arts Festival, FESPAC 2024. You know, we take you out to Waimanalo, where preparations have been underway to create the pieces that will be put in place for the big event, for the big festival. Here to tell us about how it's going to come together is HPR reporter Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so you were out in Waimanalo looking at these hale.
Last week on Friday, yes, it was a very interesting endeavor and an adventure. We actually got stuck in the mud somewhere because one of the crew members brought the wrong car.
Okay.
But last week on Friday, the crew that was there on Waimanalo, they just finished their last hale. So this coming FESPAC that's going to happen at the main hub at Festival Village at the Hawaii Convention Center, there's supposed to be 28 hale, and they're all made of invasive trees. Three trees, actually, is albizia, macarenga, and even gunpowder. Hmm. Yeah, that gunpowder tree is actually a plant that actually was used as like a propellant for firearms once upon a time ago.
Interesting.
I'm not too sure anymore.
But that's good that they're using invasive plants.
They are. And it was a huge collaboration between the festival planners, Albizia Project, the Sovereignty Group, Nation of Hawaii, Hawaii Architects, and even the Department of Land and Natural Resources. In fact, DLNR was the one who removed more than 1,000 trees out of about 2 acres of land in Waimanalo. And in turn, the crew members from the Albizia Project and Nation of Hawaii are the ones that are actually building the actual hale. But they were given a short amount of time. They actually started the project in March and just finished last Friday.
Holy cow. Yeah, so a lot of work prepping, you know, probably scraping the bark, you know, sanding things.
Yep. And I spoke with Joey Valenti, who's the co-founder of the Albizia Project, and he said they were given a short timeline to complete this project that they started earlier this year.
The bottleneck for us was actually debarking the trees. We expected that, but it was a lot of work, and we can't build the structure until the bark is removed. So very grateful for the Hawaiian brothers that did all of that work with us, because they were able to commit their efforts and have the foresight to what timeline was with our time frame. And together we were able to kind of keep that bottleneck moving. So part of our crew would be constantly removing bark, and the other part of our crew would be constantly building. And we would rotate, so everyone would get different skills and training. And by the end of it, we were able to streamline, basically cutting the construction of these down to about an hour.
So that's a short amount of time that they were given. So their job was basically to debark and build out the hale, and the thatch, which is the roof of the hale, actually isn't from here. It's actually from Mexico. Mm-hmm. So it's not coconut palm, but it's a type of palm leaf that had to be fire treated. And the festival planners had to buy it from a company in California and ship it over here. But the conversations that were happening before, planners initially wanted the thatch or the roof of the hale to actually be kind of like this plastic material. But mm-hmm. there was some pushback saying like that's not really a realistic kind of look to villages, to have this village look.
Yeah, so interesting, but I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, and this is a very expensive festival. The Festival Village build-out is actually the most expensive out of everything else in the $20 million budget. So the Festival Village is going to cost $2.9 million. That's for the design, the fabrication, and the lighting and projection. But what's going to happen at this Festival Village, so they're going to be delivering the actual hale starting tomorrow, and they're going to finish building out the hale this coming Sunday. But the actual construction of the village, the time frame that I was given by Linda Lalakis from Architects Hawaii, is that they will finish by June 4th. So that's a very tight stretch before the festival begins on June 6th.
Right. And these hale, they're much larger than maybe what we would normally see.
Yeah. So Linda told me that the hale are actually a fourth larger than a traditional hale. So these hale are actually 20 feet wide, 30 feet long, and they're also 18 feet tall. So they're pretty much huge. But it's supposed to fit what's supposed to be for 28 hale for 28 delegations. So that's supposedly there's supposed to be like 100 from each Pacific nation and territory that's coming.
Wow. So these are kind of like giant canoe houses.
Yeah. And what Linda Lalakis also told me is that when you enter the festival village, you're also going to see this huge projection of the constellation of stars. But it's supposed to give the viewers more of an insight of how to navigate or how Pacific Islander navigators use the stars to navigate throughout Polynesia, Micronesia, and Melanesia.
Yeah, no, I'm starting to get very excited now as we start to tick down the days.
But getting chicken skin.
Yes, but thank you so much, Cassie. We have been talking with HVR's Cassie Ordonio. You can find her Festback coverage on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Feel the rhythm, rhythm of the ocean, moving and grooving to the wind and the rain. Hear the rhythm, rhythm of the ocean, hear it right where you are. Rhythm of the ocean, rocking and rolling to the moon and the stars. Hear the rhythm, rhythm of the ocean, hear it calling your name. Feel the rhythm, rhythm of the ocean.
On the next Fresh Air Weekend, Kristen Wiig. She was a beloved cast member on Saturday Night Live and starred and co-wrote the film Bridesmaids. She's in the new TV series Palm Royale. Also, we hear from singer-songwriter Maggie Rogers. In 2021, Rogers felt burnt out and took a break from music to go to Harvard Divinity School. She has a new album called Don't Forget Me. Join us.
Beginning Sunday afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, committed to supporting Native Hawaiian homeowners and renters impacted by the Maui wildfires. More about its Kanaho grant at oha.org/kanaho-grant.
Cockroaches. It may seem like they're everywhere, but it didn't used to be that way. Take the German cockroach, one of the main species of the pest that you can find in Hawaii and the North Pole. It can't fly, nor does it live long enough to spend weeks at sea. So how did this cockroach get here? Well, a new study looks at that. Scientists looked at the DNA of close to 300 German cockroaches from 51 sites, including Hawaii. And these are not the big B-52s that we know of. These are smaller roaches. But the scientists found evidence that the critters had an Asian ancestor over 2,000 years ago, and that Hawaii's cockroaches probably came from the continental U.S. Chen Tong led the research. He spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about his team's study.
I started my PhD in 2011. I'm particularly interested with the German cockroach because it is so common, but it seems like there's not many studies about it at that time. And also, like, it's so widespread, but people don't know where they're from. So after that, we start to look at literatures, try to trace the origin of this species. So the German cockroach was first described in Europe 250 years ago. And then we collected the regional first records. It seems like it's expanding from Europe to the rest of the world. And the first regional records actually peaked in early 20th centuries, which is, there's a lot of things going on in the early 20th centuries, the intensive globalization because of wars and commercial activities. That is the hypothesis of my PhD thesis, which the German cockroach introduced to Europe 250 years ago and then spread to the rest of the world with the European-like activities. And then we try to collect samples to perform a population genetic analysis to try to see if that's true, because we're also aware that the historical record may be biased.
And one of the places that you took cockroaches from was Hawaii. And I was wondering if you could just describe your sampling approach.
So actually, there are quite a few scientists studying cockroaches. So we contacted them, and then they have their own like connections to the local pest control operators. So these pest control operators, when they doing their jobs of pest management, they help us to collect some individuals. So the samples in Hawaii is actually collected by my collaborator, Prof. Edvago in Texas A&M University.
Could you describe in basic terms, like how you can get DNA out of a cockroach?
Yes, that's a good question. So for cockroach, it's a bit different from the others. You know, like we try to avoid the abdomen because in the intestine, there's always like microbes. But also in cockroach, if you crash a cockroach, you see white stuff. That's the fat body. So in the fat body cells, they are also like living organisms, like protists or bacteria living in those cells and then live with the cockroach. So we try to avoid the abdomen. So my sampling is with the legs. So the legs is basically muscles. We take 2 to 3 legs and then crush them and then use a regular, like the commercial DNA extraction kit to get the DNA from the samples.
It's kind of good timing that we're talking about this because I have friends visiting Hawaii from out of state and they told me, oh my gosh, there are so many cockroaches everywhere, but this is an island in the middle of the Pacific. So how did they even get here?
Our analysis shows that the Hawaiian cockroach have no difference. There is no difference between the German cockroach in Hawaii and the ones in mainland United States. So to explain that, it seems like commercial or like passengers have brought the German cockroach from the mainland United States to Hawaii instead of, for example, like the next nearby continent is Australia, but it seems like not from Australia, but from the United States. So we also found that regardless of geographic proximity, the German cockroach populations are more closely related if they have more frequent commercial connections.
So countries or continents that have closer trade routes or a closer economic connection seem to have similar cockroaches when you look at their genetic makeup, because potentially you have shipping containers, you have trade going back and forth between these places, and it's easy for cockroaches to hitch a ride.
Yes.
Out of curiosity, why did you choose Hawaii as one of the sites? Is it because of that question of, oh, did the cockroaches get here from the mainland, or could they have come from Australia or even Asia?
Yes, yes. Actually, I'm very glad to have the Hawaiian population for the reason that you just mentioned. Yeah. And also, this subject to the availabilities and the numbers of collaborators and their willingness to cooperate. So for example, the entire South America, we just get like one sample point in Brazil. So of course, we would welcome more samples.
Are there any other questions that you want to answer in future research? Like, what are still the questions you have about the German cockroach?
Actually, the more you study these species, the more questions you will have. For example, like you know the origin and you know the time frame. So 2,000 years ago, these German cockroach may be just like regular, like wild species, insect species, feeding on leaf litters. And what makes it evolve so rapidly? And then to develop all these traits that adapt to a so different environment that was dominated by humans. So this is a potentially very interesting topic with a lot of research questions. In the future, we would like to explore that a bit more. So for example, this insecticide resistance, is that the German cockroach have a so strong ability to develop new mutations, new genes to cope with this insecticide in such short time, in like 100 or 200 years? Or it is something already in their genes, but with the pressure from human, it become like more obvious.
As you learn more, there are even more questions. And I love that reframing of it, because we think of cockroaches as pests. We think, why are they everywhere? But from the cockroaches' perspective, they're incredibly successful evolutionarily.
Maybe I'm just speculating. Maybe next time if need to like to explore the universe, like travel to another suitable planet, maybe can send cockroaches. I don't know.
How do you think about cockroaches? Like, if you see one in your house, what do you do?
I won't do much, actually. I would just keep the kitchen or rooms cleaner. Maybe there's less. And then I probably will not use the insecticide, as I know that they are not effective. So as long as they are not too abundant, then I won't be so worried about it, because I'm not allergic to it. A lot of people are allergic to the cockroach. So having cockroach in the home may make them like uncomfortable or sick. So that's a concern for many people, but not for me.
Yeah, for you, it's just like, oh, we're taking research home with us.
Well, that was Chen Tong, a postdoctoral researcher at Harvard University, talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. Tong says he won't kill a cockroach he finds in his house, but we will have a link to his new research published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences on the conversation page of our website after the show. And just to update our listeners, if you have not heard, the jury in the trial of former President Donald Trump has reached a verdict guilty on 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. It stems from a case that began with the payment to porn star Stormy Daniels. NPR will have special coverage on the verdict at the top of the hour on All Things Considered. We'll be right back after a break.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hello, I'm Russ Hudson, author of The Wisdom of the Enneagram. And next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about 9 unique pathways to presence.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Disappearing packages, undelivered letters. If you've been having problems with your mail lately, you are not alone.
Someone who had written a Christmas card to their daughter in England saw that the letter went across the Atlantic Ocean 7 times.
Big changes and big problems at the U.S. Postal Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2, following The Daily.
Calling All Quilt Lovers, a new exhibit kicks off on Oahu today with a limited run that features the textile creations of the Hawaii Quilt Guild. We talked to Irene Sasaki, one of the co-chairs of the exhibit, about what to expect from the show entitled 40 Shades of Red.
So we started out, you know, humbly with about 20-ish members who got together and started meeting, and they decided that, you know, we needed to have a clothing community. So they started that in 1984. And that same year, apparently, they started the first quilt show at the Kailua Public Library. And then since then, we've pretty much had a show every single year except for the COVID years.
I love that you started in a library.
I mean, it's perfect because obviously with, you know, 20 some odd people, that's like the perfect size for us. But now we've grown. We have over 150 members in our guild. And so we have, I think it's about 48 people who actually put in a quilt to display. So, you know, about a third of our membership did something, you know, which is cool. We just get excited when our members actually participate in the activities that we have. The things that we're selling in our gift shop, all of our members made things. So we have such an assortment of goodies and gifts, and it's amazing that a lot of people did not make the same items. So it's such a nice wide variety, everything from little zipper pouches and bags to quilts and pillowcase covers, and such an assortment of items.
Not only will people get to enjoy the creations by your members, but they'll also be able to purchase items.
Yes, we do also have some quilts for sale, so it'll be clearly marked on the tag as to which quilts are for sale. But yeah, most of the quilts, unfortunately, we make it for ourselves, we make it for friends, we make it for family members, and so they're not for sale.
Tell us about the theme of this year's show.
So this year's show is themed 40 Shades of Red because it is our 40th anniversary, and the anniversary stone is the ruby. So it works out perfectly that we wanted something to do with the color red. Every year we have a special challenge that members can participate in. And the challenge this year was to get 40 fabrics that are red and should be different fabrics and arrange them somehow and create a quilt with the 40 fabrics. And you can use a little bit more than the 40, but really we wanted to try to keep people to around 40. So that also when you look at the quilt, you'll say, my gosh, that's a red quilt. So it's very deliberate, and it's really, really fascinating to see what people came up with, you know, and how creative they were in using the 40 fabrics.
This whole idea then of the 40 shades of red, I mean, I imagine you're just going to have a really interesting array of quilts to display.
Yes. So we've got 21 quilts that are going to be predominantly red, and then we have another... Oh, I can't even remember how many other quilts that we have that are in other categories. So we have categories like art quilts and pictorial, handmade. So we've got some handmade items. We have a new category this year called upcycle. So the idea is to go get items that you would normally would throw away and repurpose them and turn them into something. So for example, in that category, we've got one quilt that is made of blue jeans. It is extremely heavy. But she's got the picture of the pile of blue jeans that she then turned into this big quilt. We have applique. We have pieced, which is your typical, what people typically think of a quilt, is blocks pieced together. And then, of course, the challenge, 40 Shades of Red, is our seventh category. So we have quilts in all of these different categories. The cool thing is that we have viewers. Whoever comes to see our show gets to vote and pick, you know, their favorites within each category. And then we will award winners on June 7th, so the Friday before we close, we will award all the first, second, and third place winners for all the categories. It's a nice way for people to get involved, you know, with our show.
Is there any chance that this show might travel to the neighbor islands?
No. Actually, some of the neighbor islands have their own shows. So, for example, Kauai has a very active group of quilters, and they actually have their own show. One of the Hawaii quilters is here, and she submitted two of her own quilts. So she's a member of our group as well. So, yeah, they tend to have their own, you know, rather than having our stuff travel to there, because it's obviously a lot of work to take all of these quilts and hang them and all of that, because some of them are rather large. We have some very large quilts. So, you know, we don't tend to travel. The Kauai quilter, for example, she brought some of their winning quilts and did a presentation for our guild at a meeting this year.
Oh, nice. So, okay, yeah. But yeah. So you're able to get the neighbor island quilters involved as well.
Yeah, we try to if they're a member of our group, because then they can participate in our classes and all the other activities. So we do a lot more than just the quilt show, but I think our show is probably the biggest in all of the islands.
And so where can people go to see the exhibit?
It's over at Naalama Kukui on Nimitz Highway. It's the old Gentry Design Center. So I like to tell people it's between Ross and City Mill. If you pass City Mill, you've gone too far. And there should be a banner up that will say Quilt Show. So that should be easier for people to come and find us. We open on Thursday, May 30th. And open from 10 to 5 every day except for Sunday, which is open from noon to 5. But we'll be here until Sunday, June the 9th.
And it's free?
It is absolutely free, yes. Okay. We are upstairs in the atrium, and there are handicap spots and a couple of elevators, so mobility should not be an issue.
Okay. Anything else you think that our listeners should know just about the group and the exhibit?
We do have a featured artist. So we not only do we have our challenge, but Estelle In is our featured artist, and she tends to make quilts that are applique with a lot of hand embellishment. So she'll add things like crystals and beads and sequins and yarn and just all sorts of things to her quilts. I like to consider them to be like very whimsical and fun. So it should brighten people's day if they just come and see Estelle's quilt.
And that was Irene Sasaki, who was one of the co-chairs of the Hawaii Quilt Guild exhibit that opened at 10 o'clock today. The group welcomes new members, and it offers classes and quilting bees at various locations across the island. There is even a virtual bee to help keep quilt lovers connected.
What can changes in prom fashion tell us about what being a teen looks like today? My guest this week says that the prom dress is getting more grown up.
You know, the prom dress trends are mirroring adult trends in a lot of ways. In some cases, adults are wearing the exact same dresses.
What the adultification of the prom dress says about the blurring of age and fashion. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Beginning Saturday at noon.
Support for HPR comes from Mobi, a Hawaii wireless company serving the island since 2005, committed to providing personal service to each customer, featuring a locally based customer care team. Learn more at mobi.com.
You may know her as Cassandra from Wayne's World, or Nani from Lilo and Stitch, or from one of her hundreds of film and TV credits. Or you may know her as a Grammy winner, one of the few to win one for Hawaiian Music Album of the Year. However you know her, there's no denying that Oahu native Tia Carrere has blazed a trail in the entertainment industry for her Hawaii-born performers, Asian Americans, and Pacific Islanders. The Conversation's Rosa Subiono got the chance to talk to Carrere about her nearly 40-year career ahead of the close of AAPI Heritage Month.
I was born and raised in Kalihi Valley, all the way at the end of the road. And, you know, so the school for the district was Farrington. And, you know, we're a Filipino, strong Catholic. They wanted me to go to Catholic school and all that kind of stuff. So I had to catch the bus an hour each way to get to Sacred Heart. But it was great for me. And I think the fact that it was hard to get to school, it made me value the honor of going to a good school, that your parents worked hard. It's like very immigrant, you know, kind of mindset. Like my great-grandparents came over on a boat from the Philippines on my mom's side and worked the plantation, like 11 people in the house. And it was always education was your way up and out. And so like my grandma, who was like the older one, she helped put her younger sibling through nursing school. And so I learned that kind of pulling other people up from my grandma. And unfortunately, I never got to go to college because it was, you know, it's expensive and, you know, it was not a good time in my family to be able to do that. So I just went straight to work, and it's lucky that I got discovered in a grocery store in Waikiki. That's how I got my first movie. Before that, I was just singing because I was entering every talent contest, doing brown bags to stardom, and that was my exposure to show business. So at least I wasn't shy when I got in front of people or in front of a camera, you know?
You mentioned that you got discovered in the grocery store, and that led to the role of Lonnie in Aloha Summer, right?
Aloha Summer, yeah. A little tiny movie that came out years later because it was, you know, a little indie movie. And the reason why, I think when I came to Hollywood, I had a resume with like female lead in a movie and with this, you know, recognizable name, Chris Makepeace. And he was in a My Bodyguard movie that was big at the time. And, you know, I got an agent, I got representation, and agencies are like, well, we don't have anybody like you, but, you know, we'll give you a shot. And I think that definitely helped a lot. So every little step forward, I'm glad I had the opportunities that I had, but I wish I didn't have to leave Hawaii to get them. But that was the only way back then. If I could stay in Hawaii and work, I would have.
Going back to Aloha Summer real quick, I had the opportunity to watch it the other day. I think I found it on YouTube. And it it surprisingly kind of touches on some local and cultural issues that people outside of Hawaii may not have known about. And you have this scene with Andy Bumatai's character where he talks about his feelings about people from the mainland.
What's the matter?
You know, I hate when the kind of rich howly stare at you dressed like that, you know. You know, daddy would get sick if he seen you in that outfit. There's no way for me to make money, you know.
Their money seems good enough for you to die for.
Hey, if they stupid enough for Chomo, they are smart enough for go get them, okay?
What's wrong with you this morning?
What's wrong with me? The same thing that's wrong with me every morning. When more howlies come to Hawaii, they only mess things up. But they can just stay on the mainland, eh?
You know, you're so prejudiced, you should move to Mississippi.
What was it like to work on a film about Hawaii with people from Hawaii that was shot in Hawaii at a time when people probably looked at Hawaii through like the lens of Elvis movies?
Yeah, I literally had a pen pal that thought we lived in huts and wore glass shirts. I was like, wow. I mean, it was like they're in the Midwest or I don't know. And they just had this image of us. And I think there still is some fetishizing of Hawaii as a backdrop for other people's glamorous stories, even as recent as, I don't know, what, Pearl Harbor or the local people. It's like you don't even see local people in these big movies that come to Hawaii. It's kind of trippy. Or The Descendants. It's like, you know, I'm like, no, I come from the opposite of The Descendants. It's a place that you probably wouldn't even go as a tourist, honestly. So to have that Romeo and Juliet storyline with Andy Bumatai and I and, you know, the Caucasian Casanova that comes in, and there is a lot of people falling in love with different ethnic backgrounds, but there is that line of, well, you're local, you're not local, or you're same ethnicity or not. I think more now than before, there's all this cross-pollinization of all the different people that came to Hawaii that worked the plantations. So everybody's like, I had a boyfriend in high school that was Hawaiian, Chinese, Portuguese, African-American, Cheyenne, Indian. I mean, like five or six different ethnic backgrounds. Right? Because everybody mixed up in the plantations.
Right.
And then the military came to the islands and then you mixed up even further. So I think there's more acceptance, I think, and diversity. But also, I think we have a long way to go in telling our stories of how we got to where we are today. Every time I try to work on something, I want to shoot it back in Hawaii, but they're like, oh, no, it's too expensive, or we're going to have to fly everybody in, or reasons why it can't be there. We can shoot it somewhere else where it's cheaper. Like, but you don't understand. That's the magic of where I'm from, my hometown. And it's unlike anywhere else. And you can't approximate the pigeon. So I always try to do my best to bring it back home. But it's been an uphill battle. I've written like three scripts now that I've been trying to bring back home. But it's always like, oh, well, first of all, it's too marginalized a story. You know, it's like, can you put a white lead in it? I'm like, holy cow, haven't we gone past this? So I'm still fighting the fight today that I, you know, had to do in sort of a glamorous 1959, you know, kind of story and back in my first movie, Aloha Summer, but it's still a thing of having local stories told and valued, hopefully with our talk about diversity and inclusion, that I can actually get them financed now. I mean, back when I came out in 1984, whoo, yeah, I'm old. It was very much Chinese, are you Japanese, you work in a tea house, you're a Viet Cong or whatever. There wasn't the wealth and the depth of characters that you see now. And I remember, I don't know, maybe it's in the 90s, like late 90s or even early 2000s, more like, please submit people of different ethnic backgrounds. I would say like 20 to 25, blonde hair, blue eyed, blah, 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 whatever. And I would see that for the longest time. And I would audition for things and they'd say, that was a really great audition, but we're not thinking about going ethnic with that role. We're not thinking about going Asian with that role. We weren't thinking of going exotic with that role. And I hit my head against the wall for the longest time with that. And then finally, somewhere around the 90s, I think we started seeing, please submit other people of various ethnic diversity.
That leads me to my question about Wayne's World. That seems to be the role that kind of catapulted you into the national consciousness, or at least into my generation's consciousness.
Totally.
Hey, Raymond, Calypso doing the line, please. And would you give me a towel?
Wow, you're really well.
Thanks. Hey, you're that party type guy on TV, Wayne, right?
Yes, and you are?
Cassandra.
Cassandra. Rough night, huh? Everybody's kung fu fighting.
Yeah. Well, nice meeting you.
Hey, hold on. Can I call you sometime?
You got $5, you can come to the red party. It's at my loft.
I'm there.
Okay. They easily could have casted, you know, any other ethnicity in that role, but you got the role. So what's the story behind landing the role of Cassandra in Wayne's World?
Well, I always give props to Mike Myers because he wanted the role to be Asian. And there was something that was fascinating to him, that people would be in these rock bands sounding like, you know, an American rocker. But then when they step off stage, they'd have this heavy accent, whether it was from, you know, Hong Kong, as it was with Cassandra in Wayne's World, or Arnel Pineda from the Philippines. In his mind, maybe it was like an additional comic boost, but it was always, you know, isn't it fascinating how this is the case that they'll approximate the accent of the American rocker performing on stage? And he just liked the idea of a kick-ass broad. Can you say that on radio?
Yeah.
He always enjoyed that kind of like tough rocker chick. And it's still a great high water mark of Asian AAPI female roles in film history today. And I'm really grateful and proud that that got to be me. And then from there, you know, to continue working and being in big movies like Rising Sun, which was written Japanese and African-American, and then True Lies, I love to point to as that was the one that was a huge movie that was not written for any specific ethnicity. And that was the huge coup for me. I was so grateful when I got that role because I was like, yes, finally. She could have been any ethnicity. And that made me so happy that I got to that point finally in my career.
I took a look at your IMDb page. And after Wayne's World, you've had roles in close to 100 productions.
Really?
Yeah. nearly 100 in both live action and animated film and TV. Those roles include, like you mentioned, the one in True Lies. You're the voice of the older sister, Nani, in Lilo and Stitch. And just a couple of years ago, you played Tita Teresa in Joe Coy's Easter Sunday movie, which I thought you were hilarious in. And I know that lady. I've seen that lady at plenty of parties. Is there a project or a role in there that you're particularly proud of or fond of?
Like I said, with True Lies, I was really proud of the fact that it didn't have anything to do with ethnicity or any specific geographic pin in the map, that it was like the best actress to convey this type of femme fatale a la, you know, James Bond.
Now, why are you helping these raving psychotics?
Because they're very well-funded raving psychotics. And I'm getting a lot of money. What, you think I care about their cause? Or yours? Not at all.
It was the first time that I got a role just being me and playing it the way that I did. So that was very gratifying. And to get to work with Jim Cameron, Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jamie Lee and all these incredible at the top of their game, you know, that I was invited to play in that sandbox. It was just, I couldn't even believe my luck.
It was so cool to go to the movies and see a summer blockbuster and see someone that looked like us up there on the screen. And I feel like you inspired a whole generation of Hawaii performers, Asian American performers, Pacific Island performers to pursue acting. And so I just think that's an incredible kind of legacy to have. Do you feel any particular way about opening the door for more people from Hawaii, more Asian Americans, more Pacific Islanders?
I feel like I'm, you know, another paving stone, you know, you put in the yard that you go from from the front gate to your front door. I'm just like another step in the right direction, I hope. So many people have contributed to this path to where we are today, and I hope we continue, you know, where we can get financing for the kinds of roles and stories that we want to tell, because that's the last key to really having our full expression in the marketplace. The Hollywood box office is a pie that everybody fights for a piece of it, and it's all about perceived demographic value or whatever. And so, like, if we put our money where our mouth is, if we show up to movies with Hawaii performers and we show up and pay for the tickets at the movies, like, I went to go to Beverly Hills and I bought a ticket to go see Waikiki, but there was like just a few people in the theaters, hardly anybody there. And I was like, I know there's more people from Hawaii that could have gone to see this movie up here. You know, get some, whoever, the newspapers or advertising sponsorship so that you can get the story out so people know that this is a local movie that needs to be supported by local people, or even your, you know, your family in the mainland that moved to the mainland now because they couldn't afford to live in Hawaii anymore. If we can support local projects, that's what I keep advocating for. Putting your money where your mouth is. Keep trying to bring projects back home, even though they want you to go to Atlanta or Timbuktu, because we need that extra push to get the stories out there that are very specific and very dear to our hearts. And it's not an easy path, and I'm still doing it 40 years later.
Thanks so much for your time today, Tia. Really appreciate being able to talk to you.
Thank you. I'm just excited to be invited to the luau.
And that was veteran actress and Grammy-winning singer Tia Carrere talking with HPR's Russell Cibiono. They were talking about paving the way for Asian American and Pacific Islander performers in the entertainment industry. Well, that does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we plan a call-in show about the rising cost of property insurance, the price we are paying due to climate change. Live in a condo or townhouse, and if you've seen your insurance soar, we want to hear about it. What's it like on your island? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.